Hello, I'm Fred Stella, president of the Interfaith Dialogue Association. Welcome to another edition of Common Threads. Last week, we began our conversation with Dr. Larry Brilliant. He's the author of a memoir entitled Sometimes Brilliant, The Impossible Adventure of a Spiritual Seeker and Visionary Physician Who Helped Conquer the Worst Disease in History. A little bit about Larry. He is an MD. He is a pioneering physician, a visionary technologist, and global philanthropist, a medical officer for the UN's World Health Organization, and member of the central team in smallpox eradication in India. He was the first executive director of Google.org and currently serves as chairman of Skoll Global Threats Fund. Larry co-founded the SAVA Foundation, whose programs and partners have restored sight to more than 4 million blind in dozens of countries. He has worked with four presidents, the UN, G8, and chaired the National Biosurveillance Advisory Subcommittee. He co-founded one of the first digital social networks, The Well. He resides in Northern California, and we're speaking to him while he is there right now. So, Dr. Larry Brilliant, welcome once again to Common Threads.
Thanks, Fred. Thanks for having me back.
We spent so much time on your life before India, and there are so many questions I could ask you about all of the other fun things that you did before you went to India, but really, India is about the most important part of your book. So you set the stage. You were with a merry band of folks traversing Europe, the Middle East, and you ended up in India. At that time, when I say merry band, I'm talking about a really merry band. You were with Wavy Gravy, and that's so interesting because, again, I did not know that Wavy Gravy had a life of any kind after Woodstock. I mean, I remember that iconic call for breakfast in bed that people of a certain age will all also remember, and that toothless smile of his. And then I didn't realize, but he has been very significantly active on the scene, but perhaps a little bit more regionally, I'm guessing. But he and you, your wives and other people, you really lived the hippie dream of traversing through Europe and into India. So tell us a little bit about that segment.
Well, you know, there's an old expression from the 60s, you're on the bus or you're off the bus. And that bus was Ken Kesey's bus, the electric Kool-Aid acid test bus. And a group of us worked as extras in a Warner Brothers movie living on these buses. And I was a rock doc doing the medical tent for a lot of rock and roll concerts for the Grateful Dead and the Jefferson Airplane. And we ended that movie with a big concert in Canterbury in England, a Pink Floyd concert, Dark Side of the Moon. And when it was over, about 40 of us wanted to keep going. And we had seen this terrible cyclone in what was then East Pakistan. First reports were 1 million people died, maybe 500,000 people actually died, but it was just so awful. And the response from the United Nations was a little slow. So we thought if we would get some donations in London and buy a couple of buses and drive from London to Bangladesh, we could deliver medicine and food. And so we drove all the way through Europe and Turkey and Iran, Iraq, Pakistan, Afghanistan, into India. And when we got to the border, the war had broken out between East and West Pakistan. It became Bangladesh. And we took that food and those medical supplies, and we started delivering it to little villages all over. And I think what's really important is that we probably looked like Martians, Fred. You think about what we look like when we went into a Kurdish village at the foot of Mount Ararat or an Afghani village, you know. But if it was a Muslim village, in the center of that village, there'd be a little altar and there'd be a picture of Mecca. If it was a Hindu village, same. but maybe there'd be an image of Vishnu or Shiva. Buddhist village, same, but a statue of Buddha. Christian village, little church-like icon with either a picture of Jesus or a cross. But not every time. 2 out of 10 times, maybe. Next to that cross, next to that picture of Mecca or that image of Buddha or Vishnu, there would be a photograph of John F. Kennedy all over Afghanistan, Iran, Pakistan, Nepal. That's what we were. That's what America was then. I mean, and aspirationally, let's be honest, there was the war in Vietnam. There were the Japanese internment camps. We were far from being perfect. But for those villagers, whatever their religion was, all throughout that area that is now a war-torn area, my kids can't make that trip. There was this aspiration that somewhere in the world, there was a rich nation filled with good people, and their leader was this guy, John F. Kennedy. And it's going to be a long time before there'll be a picture of another American president in those sacred places in the center of those villages.
No, I disagree. There must be hotels in those cities.
You got me on that one.
Yeah, but go ahead. Point taken.
You got me on that one. Well, I mean, I think we need to, that's our task. That's our spiritual task, is to build a nation that deserves to be aspirationally, at least, thought of as a friend and as a kind of a rich uncle. And that was the feeling that you got as you traveled, as I traveled, with a bunch of hippies all over that part of the world.
And tell us how you met your guru, the circumstances, and what that meant to you at this time in your life.
Well, after we decided we were going to trek in the mountains, and Wavy and his wife and Girij and I, my wife and I, we walked from the flat area of Kathmandu all the way up to the high mountains of Annapurna. By the way, my wife and I have been married 47 years, and Wavy and his wife have been married 50 years. And they say hippie relationships don't last, so we obviously have a different point of view.
I understand that. I understand that.
Yeah, we walk.
Let me tell you. Hang on, Larry. I have to tell you, it was so funny because in reading your book, you talk about this woman as getting married and all of that, and then there's something in the foreword that indicates that you're married now. I didn't expect the woman in the foreword to be the woman in the epilogue.
Of course not. No. I mean, we have this image of the transactional relationships among hippies.
Yes.
But between Wavy and his wife and Jahanara and Girij and I, we've been married, 100 years.
That's outstanding. But okay, go ahead.
Wavy was sick. Wavy got sick on that trek into the mountains, and I wanted to make sure he got good medical care. So I came back down from the mountains to get him on a plane to go to the United States, and he was really well treated at Roosevelt Hospital in New York. And then I marched off into Southeast Asia, and I started, kind of walking on my own through Laos and Thailand and all through Japan. But my wife stayed in India, and she started taking meditation courses, Buddhist meditation. And at one of those courses, she met someone who said, "Do you want to meet Ram Dass's guru?" And Ram Dass was kind of a legend in the 60s. He still is. We're going to go spend some time next month with him, where he lives in Hawaii. And so she did. So she went to this ashram, and she met Neem Karoli Baba, our guru. And he gave her a new name. She changed her name from Elaine to Girija. That might have been some of your confusion in the book. Same person, different names. And then she started phoning me. I had to come back to India and meet this guru. I had no interest in meeting an old man, an Indian guru, where everybody was touching his feet and there were idols all around. And people were doing idol worshiping and touching his feet. I kept saying to her, "I won't come." And she said, well, I won't come home. And there was that stalemate was broken when there was a war between India and Pakistan. And Neem Karoli Baba, he would become my guru, he said, I want all the Westerners to go home. I don't want them to be at risk of being caught up in this war. So she called me and said that Neem Karoli Baba said that she could come home, provided I promised I would come back after that war. And I did promise. We made a deal. And she came back. I paid off my medical school debts. Took us about 6 months. We paid off all the debts from traveling. I had to get a little surgery on a tumor that I had. And then we went back to India. And I walked into this picture book ashram at the corner of India and China and Tibet and Nepal, right in that little corner in the Himalayas. And I hated it. I hated it, Fred. It was everything that I had been warned against, almost including that golden calf kind of image from Ben-Hur. I was going to say,
if I can stop you for a second, one of the very interesting things about the book is that even though you really embraced so much of Hinduism, you've never stopped looking at the world through a Jewish lens. And that is the lens that I see that you saw Neem Karoli Baba and the statues and everything. So it was just an observance. But go ahead.
I think the part of Judaism that I do have as an organizing principle is the part of the moral conviction, something called tikkun olam, that every Jew and by extension every person is supposed to heal the broken world. We're supposed to spend our life making the world better for our children. In fact, you'd have to help me, but I've forgotten the Catholic writer who wrote The Gift of the Jews and How the Irish Saved Civilization, this wonderful man. But he says the gifts of the Jews...
Muggleridge? Is it Muggle?
No. An Irish... I'm so embarrassed. Cahill.
Okay, yeah, that's right.
And he said that the gift of the Jews isn't anything about, Torah or the Bible or even monotheism. He says the gift of the Jews is the belief that if you work hard, the next generation will be better than this one. Next year will be better than this year. This idea of progress that we've incorporated even into the American dream. And I buy into that. I buy into the idea that we can make the world a better place, that as Martin Luther King said, you can pull that arc down towards justice, and we can live in a world of peace and prosperity if we all work together. And that's a pretty basic Jewish concept that I'm really attracted to. But there's this cultural part of monotheism, which is true for Christianity and Islam and Judaism. I was really uncomfortable in the polytheistic world of Hinduism. I probably at that time would have been uncomfortable in the atheistic world of Buddhism. But I had an experience with this guru that I couldn't, as a scientist, explain away, where one day he was holding my beard and stepping on my hand and looking at me. And it just seemed to me that he loved everyone in the world in a way that I had never experienced before. And I can't, that mystical experience, that peace which passeth understanding, is so difficult to explain in words. But it wasn't just that he loved everybody in the world, which was sort of intellectual thing. It was, and he should love everybody in the world. He's a guru. He's a priest. Every rabbi, every priest, every minister should love everybody in the world. That's part of their job. Every mullah should love everybody in the world. Every imam should love everybody in the world. But what was transcendental for me was that in that moment, I loved everybody in the world. I loved the people that I had marched against. I loved the people that I had a different political view. I loved the people who had been unkind to me at some point, or I had witnessed doing acts of unkindness. And all of that while he was playing with my beard, pulling my beard, and kind of, you know, tapping me across the cheek and saying, and called me Dr. America. That was the name he gave me, which I've done my best to write about that in this book. I know that it's inadequate. It's never adequate to describe that mystical experience. And for me, that was the experience that I felt. I love God in that moment. I don't think I ever had before.
And, well, first of all, let me mention that if people are just joining us, they're listening to Common Threads on WGVU. Larry Brilliant is my guest. The book we're talking about is his memoir, Sometimes Brilliant, The Impossible Adventure of a Spiritual Seeker and Visionary Physician Who Helped Conquer the Worst Disease in History. Now, Neem Karoli Baba, according to your book, is a bit of a prophet. First of all, you give the example that the Indian government actually came to him and asked him advice when China was doing a little bit of saber-rattling on their borders.
Oh, more than saber-rattling. In 1962, China invaded India in two places, one near Badrinath, which was close to the ashram that I was in at that moment, and the other part near Darjeeling. And they came down tens of miles with their army into India, and Mrs. Gandhi, then the prime minister, had to decide whether to fight them militarily or let them essentially overrun all the military arms places where they'd stored their weapons, in which case it would have been really dangerous. And the legend is that Neem Karoli Baba phoned Mrs. Gandhi or her father, who was then the prime minister, Nehru, and said, don't do anything. The Chinese will go back on their own. And the legend is that the Chinese just turned around the next day and went back on their own. I wasn't there. But that added to his sort of reputation as a seer. And my own experience was that one day he pulled me aside and said, "You're meditating, that's good. You're praying, that's good. You're trying to understand the meaning of life. You're reading all the holy books." We were reading the Old Testament and the New Testament and the Quran and the Bhagavad Gita and all the religious texts of Buddhism and Hinduism and everything Christian, Jewish we could find. He said, "That's good. But you have one more thing you have to do, and that is you've got to go down to the United Nations office, the World Health Organization office, and you're going to get a job working on eradicating a disease called smallpox, because God is going to eradicate that disease, take it away, lift it off the shoulders of humanity. This one form of suffering will be taken away from humans who already have so much to suffer from. Go. Get out of here. Go get your job." And that was preposterous. I had had no job since I graduated from medical school. I'd never seen a case of smallpox. I'd never really acted as a real doctor. And the United Nations, WHO, only hired people who are professors or, you know, 15, 20 years older than me. And it's a long story that I try to write about in the book, but I went down from the mountains, went to Delhi, went to the WHO office. They kicked me out, of course, immediately, because I looked like a hippie. They interviewed me and said, "No job for this guy. He appears to have gone native," and I had. They shouldn't have hired me.
What's the matter with going native, though? What's the matter with that? What's the problem?
Oh, it's because the idea was that you become a mystic and you give up your rational scientific mind. How can you work in a scientific program to conquer a disease?
Okay.
It wasn't all that. I mean, in retrospect, I don't feel that bad about it. At the time, of course, having to make 8, 9, 10, 15 trips down from the mountains, which were, you know, it was a very long 10, 15-hour trip each time, and I made it so many times that even though I trusted my teacher and I believed in him and I loved God, it still got a little old to keep going back down to the mountain all the time. And one day I walked in there, and the woman who was running the program and the head of the program from Geneva both interviewed me and decided that while they couldn't hire me as a doctor, that they could create a job low enough to kind of fly under the radar of the United Nations and the government of India and hire me as a clerk or a secretary. And I was thrilled. And that's how I started off. And I can just say the one thing unique about me, there's nothing else unique about me. I'm a regular person. The only thing unique is that in the annals of the United Nations, I am the only person in history whose recruitment papers said that I was recruited from the Hanuman Monkey Temple in the Himalayas. I'm the only one. That's the only thing.
And of course, we don't have time to go into what is really the most significant part of the book, and that is your adventures as you strive, along with other workers, to eradicate this horrible, horrible disease. And I was not aware of how horrible it was until I read your description of it and saw the pictures. It is astounding that the work that was done. And you did it. Congratulations,
you. We visited every house in India 20 times. That means that we made 2 billion house calls. We had 150,000 people and doctors from 170 nations. And when we would have a meeting, Fred, there would be Muslims and Hindus and Jews and Christians and Buddhists all lined up working together, and faces that were black and white and yellow, every color of the rainbow. And I think maybe that's the best thing I can end this on, or lesson, is that we saw the proof that you don't have to just live with people who look the same color as you or speak the same language or have the same religion. We saw the proof that people from all over the world, all religions, could work together to conquer something on a global scale that was so horrific that 500 million people died from smallpox, 500 million in the 20th century. It can be done. It can still be done. We're not incompetent as a species. We do love each other, and we can still accomplish great things if we work together.
You know, it's interesting because I could take that last segment, what you just said, I could re-edit it ever so slightly, and it could be the words of someone who was drafted in World War II and put into a platoon with a diversity that he had never seen before.
And that is absolutely correct. And many other times in our history, and now even working in a great army to eradicate polio. I mean, our history is replete with examples of how we buried the hatchet. I mean, in the middle of the Cold War, when Russians and Americans had 40,000 nuclear weapons pointed at each other, we buried 40,000 hatchets, I guess, to work together to accomplish great things. So, yes, many examples.
One thing that is also interesting about your book, getting back to the spirituality, is that here you are in an ashram, you are absorbing Hindu thought, and then later on you also are very focused on Buddhist thought as well with this other initiation that you had. And you're able to see that which those philosophies can offer. And yet you also have to deal with I'm just going to come right out and say it, the superstition, if you will. So for instance, the idea that people put so much emphasis on Mahashitala, the goddess. Quickly, tell us about that and how that was a challenge for you.
Well, I think you can love God and follow whatever your religion is, and not leave your brain at the door, and not pretend that everything is true and accurate. And certainly in Hinduism, when there was a deity, a goddess named Shitala Ma, that you would go to protect you against smallpox. By the way, Japan had a goddess, and Nigeria had a goddess again. So this idea that smallpox was brought to you as a form of punishment for something you did or your parents did. And it's such a horrible death from smallpox. I can't believe for a second that God will inflict that kind of punishment on anyone for any reason. But in India, it was a very difficult situation because smallpox was thought of as a deity, and to make the vaccine, you had to kill cows. The vaccine was made by, you know, creating cowpox and harvesting it from cows. So you're absolutely right. It was right in the middle of the culture of India, and so a lot of the time I spent talking to priests and pundits and lamas and Munis from the Jain religion, and that's actually part of what was my opening to being part of this interfaith community, was unless I had met with and talked with people from all the different religions that make up this wonderful diversity of India, we could not have eradicated smallpox.
Well, thank you so much for doing that for us. Just an outstanding story. Larry, if people are interested in the work that you're doing now, and I'm sorry we're out of time, we don't have any time to get into that, but you are far from retired. Do you have a website?
Sure, larrybrilliant.com.
That's easy enough. Outstanding. And right now you do a lot of work for the Skoll Global Threats Fund. Is that also medically inspired?
It was started by Jeff Skoll, a wonderful friend of mine who was the president of eBay, and he also owns Participant Movies. They won the Oscar for Best Picture last year with Spotlight, but they've had 30 Oscars. And he started the Skoll Foundation, which works on social entrepreneurship, a wonderful group. And we work at Skoll Global Threats Fund on stopping pandemics and nuclear proliferation, climate change, water, and regional war. We're very active in all of those areas.
Well, God bless you for all the wonderful work you do. Larry, it's been just a pleasure talking to you both today and last week as well.
Fred, thank you so much for inviting me. What a pleasure. Thank you.
You've been listening to Common Threads here on WGVU. I'm Fred Stella, and today my guest was Larry Brilliant, the author of Sometimes Brilliant, The Impossible Adventure of a Spiritual Seeker and Visionary Physician Who Helped Conquer the Worst Disease in History. Please join us again next week for another edition of Common Threads.